KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, March 24, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Today's topic will be Back from Iraq, featuring a panel of members of the Nebraska Army National Guard, recently returned from service in Project Iraqi Freedom. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program and the panel is Dale Munson.
Welcome to our Omaha Press Club Noon Forum. My name is Dale Munson, and I'm a member of the Press Club's Education Committee, the producer of these monthly forums. 2 years ago this month, the United States invasion of Iraq began. It is not our intent today to go into the varied reasons for the invasion, but rather to find out firsthand what it was really like to serve in a military capacity in Iraq. As is customary at our Press Club forums, audience members are encouraged to submit questions in writing to our guests, and you'll find paper and pencils on each table for that purpose. We're honored to have on our panel today four members of the Nebraska National Guard who have all served in Iraq and or Kuwait. Each soldier will have a few minutes to share some personal background and experiences, and then we'll present the questions that you submit to us. So now please welcome Captain Martin Neal, Sergeant First Class John Ausdemore, Specialist Amanda Sticka, and Specialist May Sorensen. Please give them a hand. And we'll call on rank first. Captain Neal, would you come to the microphone and share some experiences?
Thank you, Mr. Munson. First, I'd like to say it's an honor to be here today and to be able to speak with you. I'm Captain Martin Neal with the Nebraska Army National Guard. At the present time, I'm the administrative officer for the 126th Chemical Battalion here, stationed here in Omaha. I was in Iraq for approximately 1 year. In fact, looking at my watch, yesterday I realized I was home, had been home for 1 year ago, or for 1 year the day before yesterday. So it's very, very, very pleasant for me to be back. While we were in Iraq, I served with the 41st Corps Support Center, RAOC, and we served in support of the 101st Airborne Division. We actually went across the border from Kuwait in Iraq 3 to 4 days after the invasion was initiated and drove through the entire spans of the country and ended up settling in Mosul, where our unit was assigned with various missions to provide support not only to the division but also to assist the Iraqi people. We escorted fuel convoys. We also helped to rebuild numerous schools and then began conducting the training of what is now the new Iraqi Army or Army National Guard. While I was in Iraq, my wife, who is also in the Air Force, also served there from October until March, and she was primarily stationed in Baghdad. Some of my principal duties were maintaining liaison between the Corps headquarters and the Joint Task Force headquarters, assisting with those missions that I talked about earlier. And the most rewarding part of my experience of being in Iraq was actually interacting with the Iraqi citizens themselves, getting the chance to talk to the school kids, getting the chance to talk to the locals in the town of Mosul, and also getting the chance to interact with what is now the Iraqi Army. And I'll be followed by Sergeant First Class John Ausdemore.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Munson. My name is Sergeant First Class John Ausdemore. I'm currently the Senior Personnel Services NCO for the 126th Chemical Battalion in Omaha. For Operation Iraqi Freedom, I was transferred to the 110th Medical Battalion, an evacuation battalion that's headquartered out of Lincoln, Nebraska. We deployed to Camp Arifjan, Kuwait, in April of 2003. Our mission when we got over to Kuwait was we ran all medical evacuation missions out of southern Iraq and Kuwait. We had anywhere from 2 to 8 units that were under our command umbrella. We handled everything from doing dust-off missions, taking wounded soldiers out to the Navy hospital ships, to civil actions where we were sending teams of ambulances to Iraq, helping evacuate Iraqis who needed surgery that they couldn't get surgical care in Iraq through their hospitals. We were bringing them to Kuwait or to military installations. In a nutshell, that's what I did. My job over in Kuwait as the senior personnel NCO, I was responsible for taking care of all financial and personnel documentation for our unit and all the subordinate organizations. The biggest plus we had when we were over there is after hostilities were officially declared over and they started to redeploy units, our unit was used to help units in redeploying back to the United States. We helped several units to move out of Iraq and out of other countries through Camp Arifchan and go back home. I'll be followed by Specialist Sticka.
First of all, I'd say thank you for, it's an honor to be here. My name is Specialist Amanda Sticka, and I was deployed to Iraq in April of 2003, and I was looking at my watch, and it's almost been a year that I've been home. With me, that when I first left, I had actually just got home from training for, I think I was home for a month, and then I left again. So I was told I was gone for about 2 years for my family. I was stationed in Nasiriya, or Camp Cedar 2, Iraq. It's by Nasiriya. My main mission was, I'm a truck driver. I bring supplies to and from Kuwait to all over in Iraq. Can be up to food supplies, parts for trucks, MWR material, like certain foods, or sport material, like for people to play sports and stuff like that. Currently, right now, I'm at the with the 600 Trans out of Omaha. I was transferred to a unit with 1057th in Scottsbluff in Chadron, Nebraska. And I'm a student at College of St. Mary's. I'm a nursing student. I'm a freshman. And I also do the Omaha military honors funerals, so that's my job. And that's all I do. Followed by Specialist May Sorensen.
My name is Specialist May Sorensen. I'm 21. Civilian side, I work at the Twin Creek Target. I'll be starting school this summer. I'll also be getting married in May. I was deployed at the age of 19 with the 1057th Light Medium Truck Company to Iraq with Specialist Sticka. Both of us were 88 Mikes, which is a truck driver. She already covered a lot of what we did, which was to haul troops and supplies to more frontline camps, like BIOP, which is Baghdad International Airport. We also hauled supplies to Najaf. A few of our people have been to Anaconda, and a few of people have been to Fallujah. Our primary duties in Iraq were not only the hauling of supplies and troops, but also to provide security for the camp that we lived at, which was a roving patrol. We would basically drive around on the highway for about 8 hours every night or every morning, depending on which shift you got. And we would make sure that there were no suspicious personnel or vehicles. If there was, we were supposed to call for MPs to come, and usually that resulted in them being arrested by the MPs. My most pleasant memories of Iraq would be the friends I made not only with other Americans, but also with the Iraqi people and other UN soldiers from Italy and South Korea. Um, some of the other friends that I've made were Marines, sailors, Air Force, and certain ones of them were not able to return home from this war. But with the good comes the bad. I absolutely enjoyed being in Iraq. I learned a lot from my time there, as I'm sure all of us did. And I'm very thankful that you have asked me to come here and talk to you.
The two ladies touched a little bit on their civilian status. You gentlemen didn't mention it. And tell us, this questioner would like to know something more about your families. You mentioned that your wife, Captain, is in the Air Force. Is she Air Force Guard or is she active duty Air Force?
My wife is, at present time, the Deputy Base Civil Engineer for the Nebraska Air National Guard in Lincoln, Nebraska. Some of the duties that she's charged with at home, and also conversely, while she was in Iraq, she also took part in program management of the over the 18 billion plus funds that the United States people and other foreign or foreign allied nations provided the country of Iraq to help rebuild their infrastructure. And as far as my civilian job, I'm an active guard and reserve soldier. I've been in the Army National Guard for 17 years, and my full-time job is working with the Nebraska Army National Guard.
I'm married. I have four children. I should say my wife and I have four children. I'm also full-time, active guard and reserve. I've served full-time with the Army Reserve, both in Nebraska and in the state of Maryland. I've been with the Nebraska Army National Guard on a full-time basis since 1990. And yeah, I've been active duty now for 19 and a half years. My full-time supervisor would be Captain Neal. He's our administrative officer here in Omaha. He's a senior full-timer. My wife works here. My wife and I are both from Omaha. She works at Lancer Label, and all of her children are spread across three schools, one in high school, one in junior high, and two in elementary school at this time.
Ladies, do you have anything to add to your comments about your civilian status?
I think I hit everything.
Okay, you hit everything? Okay, fine. I'd like to ask you, ladies, if there were other women attached to your unit or if you were the only two, and then to follow that up a little bit more with what possessed you as young women to join the National Guard?
There were 18 females in a transportation company of about 150 people. As a female, I never really looked at it as a female when I decided to join the Guard. I was an Army brat. I was born in Fort Riley, Kansas. So military life was the only thing I really ever experienced. And I knew ever since I was about 5 years old that I wanted to do what my father did. I wanted to be part of the Army. But I also wanted to go to college. And full-time Army really doesn't get a chance to go to college. And if they do, it's usually, you know, you find time when you can and your family ends up getting neglected a little bit. So, I mean, for me, being a female really never was an issue.
When I joined the military, I didn't really think about it. I was just, one day I thought, hey, it's something I can do, and went and did it. A lot of people told me I wouldn't be able to do it, and so that gave me more incentive to go. And so when I did that, I basically came back and showed them that I could. And I just always had a very fascination of the military. I like the structure. I like having routine. I'm a big person of routine now, and it's. I never really looked at it with a female perspective, but I love it, and I couldn't imagine being without the military now. And I'm planning on doing 20 years, so I'm pretty excited.
Specialist Sticka, are you You're the one in college, right? Going to college, St. Mary's?
Yes.
Are you getting or will you get financial help from the military to attend school?
Actually, I get federal tuition assistance, which kicks in. Well, normally what I do is I first get my Nebraska State federal tuition assistance, which can hold up to 100%. But since I go to a private college, they usually give me 75%. And then the federal kicks in the last 25%. And then I also get my GI Bill, which is once a month, like a stipend pay of that.
So this is quite helpful.
Oh, yes. Especially with my college, I think I pay maybe $2,000 of the full tuition for the year.
It's good to hear. Several of you mentioned that one of the highlights of your service there was in a relationship with the Iraqi people. I'd like to explore that a little bit further from each of you, if you have a favorite story to tell or tell about some of the people you met, and how did you communicate with them? Because I would assume most Iraqis that you met
No.
did not speak English, or am I wrong there? So some of you, please take it, anybody.
I can answer part of that question. A lot of the Iraqi citizens themselves spoke somewhat broken English. I mean, English was taught in their schools, clear up until their secondary education levels. The most interesting story I have, coming from my experience in dealing with the Iraqi people themselves, some of the little villages that we would drive into and we'd help rebuild, and in some cases we'd actually build a school for this village. A lot of the villages were no different than some of the smaller towns and communities in Nebraska where I would say probably 50 to 100 years ago. Some of these villages didn't have running water in their homes. They didn't have electricity. You know, they were living in very primitive agrarian type, you know, situations where they raised sheep and they farmed what little that they could and things like that. There's one particular village in particular, when we went into almost every person that we spoke to there was so excited that now at this point in time they actually had the freedom to be able to get a passport and to leave the country of Iraq and to come to the United States. It was their entire goal. And the city of Detroit should be aware, because there's an entire village that's going to eventually move there whenever they can get the money that is required to get out of the country. And so, but other than that, just in talking with some of the university students in and around the city of Mosul, I remember one day we were walking down the street and we were stopped and talking to some of the university students about the very principles of freedom and democracy and things like that. And, you know, they couldn't believe I kept chiding one individual. You know, he could possibly be the next president or the future president of Iraq, and he couldn't believe. He was kind of blushed a little bit when I kid him about it. And those kind of things. Those were the rewarding experiences. also, as we trained part of the new Iraqi army, the company commander, who was a half-breed of sorts. His father was Arab and his mother was Kurdish, and so he had perspective of both the Muslim and the Christian religions and both sides of their culture. And essentially, you know, he equated a lot of the differences in the religions and the cultures to be the same, and there really was no differences. And it was really exciting, really interesting to listen to his stories that he told of their time while they were under the regime of Saddam Hussein, and of his time when he was a member of the regular Iraqi army. And those are some of the rewarding experiences that I had while I was there.
I touched a little bit on my unit, our most rewarding experience, and that was when we would either use helicopters. We'd push up a ground convoy into Iraq. We'd get a notification through different military units. Usually it would be a local Iraqi child that needed some kind of specialized medical treatment or surgery, and they could not get that kind of treatment where they were at, and mostly they were people that lived in these small villages. And our commander would always, raise his hand and say, you know, I'm asking for volunteers, which he really never had to do. There was never a shortage of people, either to fly the aircraft or to
put together a vehicle convoy, and we would go up into Iraq. Usually we would take, it wouldn't just be the one child. It would be if there was multiple children, and we could be bringing back two, three, four, five children and one parent and bring them back to a medical facility either run by the military or in Kuwait City so they get that medical treatment. And, you know, parents would always, you know, parents and, the, you know, the extended families would always come out. We'd bring the family back, and they, our folks would be a little embarrassed about getting thanked because all they were doing was being glorified vehicle drivers. They didn't, you know, they were doing the actual medical procedures. We were just transporting.
With doing roving patrol and driving on the streets, we got interaction with a lot of Iraqi civilians. My personal favorite is getting to sit down and drink chai with them. It's a type of tea. It's a spice tea, and that's what they do. You usually sit down and you converse, and we exchange either by signing or whatever broken English they could speak. And then I like doing that when we were conversing and learning their history, and then them wanting to know more about America and freedom and what freedom was. They asked me what they didn't have any idea of what the definition of it was. And also they got with being thank you in a way of thank you was having a conversation partner. They gave me a chance to ride on a donkey, which was quite interesting. That's their mode of transportation in some areas, and they got a laugh out of that and took pictures. Well, we took pictures, and then we like would develop them and give them pictures of us riding on donkeys. Especially as a female, they're like, whoa, you're riding on a donkey and conversing. It was a lot of fun.
I have to say that my favorite memories of Iraq will always be going out to the Pink Palace right outside of Nasiriya. It was a little open-air market, about 5-6 shops out there. And we'd go out there, and one of the men named Ali was very good with English. He could speak it very well. We would sit there in his shop on the floor, or he'd pull up a chair for us, and we'd sit there and we would talk. He would want to see pictures of my family, my mother, my father, and he would show me pictures of his children. We would just talk about our families for hours, it seemed like. And it really helped getting over the homesickness to have somebody there that really cared and wanted to hear about your family, you know? And also, with Specialist Dicka, she touched on the roving patrols, teaching the nomadic children how to play football, Americanized football. We would play soccer with them. They would show us how they played soccer, and we'd show them how we played football. And we usually, when we were finished, we'd usually split an MRE between us and the children and sit and talk for a little bit before we had to start moving again. So I really enjoyed those times. Those are probably my best memories I have of the country.
In reference to interaction with Iraqis, was there interaction with Iraqi women as well?
For me, I was able to interact with about 4 women, all very, very much older than myself or anyone else. I would have to say they were probably great-grandmothers. And we were able to interact, but it wasn't very good interaction because they could speak absolutely no English. It was more of I picked up a basic working knowledge of Arabic while I was there, very basic. So I could understand a few things that they were saying, and then the rest was signing and drawing in the sand. They were really amazed by the fact that on my roving patrol team, we had 2 females, and one of them was in charge of 2 males. They were amazed by that fact, that concept. Just they really enjoyed thinking about that. And they they invited us back to their camp to have fried bread, which of course we couldn't do because it's not a sanctioned food source, and we couldn't leave our roving patrols. So that brief interaction I had with those women was really interesting. It taught me a lot about what the Iraqi women as a whole had been going through for quite a few years.
I never really had any experiences with women. A lot of times it was, I worked the night shift, so I didn't really see very many people with women. They were usually during the day picking some type of spice that they sell in Nazaria. But my only time I ever saw women was when they were working. I never spoke to any women.
I have the same response. I didn't interact with any Iraqi women on a personal basis.
A lot of it depended on how indoctrinated they were and how hardcore or extreme into the religion that they were. We did have the opportunity to interact with several different Iraqi females, school teachers, those kind of things. One of the interesting things, within Iraq, their school system at the primary and then the secondary level is segregated. They have school, one school would teach to both boys and girls, but there would be different times of the day when there would be classes for girls and there would be classes for boys. The boys would go in the morning, the girls would go in the afternoon. And then once you get into your secondary level, the school systems would actually be all female or all male, and they wouldn't actually integrate again until post-secondary or their university level. A lot of the Iraqi women that we actually conversed and dealt with were within the schools themselves, and it just depended. Some places we would go to, the females would hide, hide themselves, and it just depended on how extreme or what their religious customs were within that particular area.
As I understand it, in Iraq itself, there are several different languages being used. Is this correct? Were you given any education as to the languages or any instruction in any of the languages you might have run into before you left?
Before we left, no. The education and the briefings that we received as far as the culture and what we could expect was very minimal, of course, because we didn't really know at that point in time. You have to realize that we went to war. I left Lincoln, Nebraska Valentine's Day, and I didn't know when I was coming home. I didn't know where I was going. We had no idea what we were going to be doing. And so the briefings and the intelligence and those kind of things like that, it was very limited. Once we were there, however, we did start some of the companies, some of the private corporations. We brought some local Iraqis in, started to teach some of the Arabic language and some of the writing and things like that. And it was pretty easy to pick up on some of those things, although I probably couldn't remember how to count to 10 in Arabic now if I was asked to. But the answer is no, initially no.
What about the training that you received before you left? Were there any big surprises for you that, oh, man, I wish they'd covered this? Or, yes, I see a head shaking down there.
There were quite a few big surprises when we got there. When we got mobilized in Fort Carson, and it was January. So it was freezing cold when we went out and did our field operations, preparing us to go and run real-time situations. So the biggest surprise for us was that we could actually survive at 150-plus degrees. That was the biggest surprise to us. We didn't know that we would actually be able to live through that. Other things that really surprised us was when we got in country and we did our briefings, they told us that the men would not be that receptive to talking to a woman. And when we got into Iraq, that was absolutely not true. They were more willing to talk to us being females than they were to talk to the other males.
Why do you suppose that was?
Well, a lot of it had to do with the fact that we were women and they could see our face. We had quite a few proposals of marriage from the Iraqi men. We had quite a few men offer to buy us from our male counterparts.
Yep.
But they liked talking to us because they really couldn't understand why there was a woman in the army. they just could not understand that, and they would talk to us and ask us why we had joined the Army. So it took a little bit of conversation to get them to understand, you know, that just because we're women doesn't mean we can't be in the Army or we can't do things that they traditionally hold to be male positions.
Any other comments along those lines?
No.
No.
I'm just not gonna talk about it.
I see no acceptances anyhow. Is that, Specialist Sorensen, you said you're getting married next month, or in May.
Yes.
Not to an Iraqi, I understand. Is that right?
No.
Not that that would be all bad,
no.
I suppose.
No.
To you folks who are truck drivers, tell us a little bit about the experience. Were you safe? Did you feel safe? Were you ever fired upon? You talked about your cargo. I'd like to throw in another zinger of a question here. Do you recall or did you experience any trucks going empty, as was reported in this country?
Going empty.
The stealing of ours.
Oh.
Here.
As truck drivers, we've had, we have to take our gear with us and put it on our trucks. We've had instances that if we slow down, we had a couple people lose sleeping bags, mop gear.
PTs.
PTs, clothing, boots. Anything that they can grab, they'll take. We've had, when we first started off with bringing water, in the beginning of our tour, if we'd slow down and if they were not very stable loads, so sometimes we'd lose water and people would be, Iraqis would run and they're like, oh, thank Allah, and they were like so excited because we dropped water. And with us being in trucks, I never really thought about, you know, the whole safety issue or anything. I just thought about getting my job done and getting the supplies to the issue to the place that we had to go from, say, when I'd leave the point A, I'd just say, okay, I'm going to make it to point B, and that was my choice. And the trucks were so loud, if we did get shot at, I didn't know about it. So, but, I don't know. Our main issue was just getting our supplies there and making it safe and not getting any accidents and making sure our trucks make it there, because we had some really old trucks, so it was interesting.
Again, the time frame that I think all four of you were there about the approximately same time, is that correct?
We were there at the same, all of us.
But it's roughly 2002
roughly.
To 2003.
Yes.
In,
or
in
2003
that,
to 2004.
Yeah.
Yeah.
3 to 4 for you.
3 to 4.
3 to 4 for you. For all? Oh, 3 to 4.
No.
He was just there for 3.
The invasion.
Oh, three.
I was the short timer.
Yeah. Okay.
All three of our units were mobilized roughly the same time. My unit was only in theater for 4 months and 2 days. We came home mid-August. We were the first of the National Guard units to come home in August of 2003. The other organizations were there until the spring of 2004.
So, tell me about this. Did any of you experience any actual combat? Was there combat? Did you drive into it? How far north did you proceed with your convoys? Tell us a little bit about that.
For me, the closest, I've had two close calls, and neither one of them do I consider combat. The closest I've ever been to an actual combat situation, on the ground combat, was when we did a convoy up to Baghdad. When we got there, we had just entered the gates, and evidently it was a normal thing that everybody that lived up there was used to. They started mortaring right behind us, right outside the gates. Didn't injure anybody, but it did scare us a little bit because it was our first interaction with any type of mortar fire. And this happened on 3 or 4 separate occasions with the mortar fire. The other close call was a friendly fire incident where the Bulgarians fired extremely close to our roving patrol element. We didn't know if they were firing at us or at something near us. So it caused us to get, you know, pretty jumpy. We had to find them to find out what they were firing at, and it turned out that they weren't even firing at us, just very, very close to us. Those are the closest things I've had to a combat situation besides hearing small arms fire in the background.
Yeah.
And As far as being actually engaged in combat, I was never actually engaged in combat. I did go on patrols with some of the Iraqi soldiers, those kind of things. We took a lot of indirect fire, a lot of rocket fire. I was actually shot at while I was flying on a C-130 landing at the Baghdad International Airport. They fired a missile at us. A lot of daily and indirect fire, and a lot of the violence that you're seeing on TV now and all of that, because if you'll remember back in that time frame, there was a brief period where there was probably 5 to 6 months, there was a pretty good lull. A lot of that violence was resurged in the summer and then in late in the fall, and it was a lot of it was linked to influences and forces that were coming from outside of the country of Iraq itself. And so it took a little while for the insurgency to get reorganized and to actually be able to conduct some of the operations that they're doing now, which is all, in my mind anyways, directly linked to trying to destabilize the fledgling country that's being created. But as far as actually returning fire in anger, I've never, fortunately, have not had the experience of doing that. I was in a couple of situations where there was a possibility that could happen, but it was never any direct combat.
I was never in a direct combat situation while I was overseas.
Let's talk about your living conditions while you were there. Specifically, this questioner says, on a scale of 1 to 10, how did you rate the chow? Then he goes on to say, I think it's a he, during World War II, I rated at about 3. And then, parenthetically, did anyone know my grandson-in-law, Dave Patterson? Talk about living conditions. Did you, as an officer captain, did you have separate billets or what? Tell us a little bit about this, and then on down the line, please.
I lived in a tent for 10 or 11 months, for the most part. Experiencing those extremes in temperatures, 120, 150 degrees. At one point in time, we actually did get an air conditioning unit. It was a civilian air conditioning unit that we had hooked up and used in our tent. And then, of course, in the winter months, we turned around and bought heaters on the local economy. As far as the food got old pretty quick. Eating MREs and then the old T rations, which is nothing more than a family-sized MRE. That got old pretty quick. We didn't actually have hot A rations except for on a few occasions until I think they opened our dining facility in September, October time frame. So from March and when we left Kuwait until September, October time frame, we were eating MREs, T rations, or whatever we could get sent from home. That was a big boost, actually. A lot of ramen noodles, and I think that the little meat packages, the little meat and cheese Christmas gift packages I was surprised that they didn't sell those year round because I was asking for those, and they just couldn't be found. But the conditions initially were pretty sparse, pretty rough. However, one of the things that we did do while we were there, we did start rebuilding some of the infrastructures, the bases. You know, the soldiers that are there now are actually living in trailers with air conditioning and heat in them, you know, two soldiers per trailer, that kind of thing. There was no favoritism. Rank didn't have its privileges as far as living conditions, and we ate and we slept pretty much with our soldiers, so.
The medical battalion was very lucky. We arrived in Camp Arifjan. We thought we were going north, and they told us we were going to be stationed there. It was a new base. They had all these very large warehouses there where they're housing vehicles. That's where the 3rd Infantry Division got fleshed out their vehicles before they went north. So when we got there, they had between 500 and 600 sets of bunk beds in each warehouse. There was no air conditioning. The only ventilation was opening up the garage doors, which were running on both sides of the building. And when the sandstorms had come in, couldn't close the doors all the way, but you tried to reduce how much dust was actually blowing in there. And it was very spartan. It was pretty spartan there for a while. We eventually, they took pity on us and moved us into, there was one large 3-story barracks on the base, and they moved us into that barracks after we'd been there a few weeks. And once they got the air conditioner fixed, we were living tremendously better than the people that were up in Iraq in between when it would actually work and wasn't broken down. The food, the MREs get old very fast. When they get the dining facility up and running, it's usually what they call a 14-day menu, so it gets very repetitive. About the only time people really had to stand in line for meals would be after we were there about a month, they started doing T-bone steak and crab leg night about once a month. So that was the one time you would guarantee that pretty much everybody wasn't going into their care packages from home and eating ramen noodles or things like that.
And before you start, ladies, again, you were stationed in Kuwait. That's where Camp Erzan was?
Yes, he was.
Sergeant, yeah. Yes. And is that where you ladies drove from there?
We actually, when we first got there, we lived in Kuwait for Camp Erzan Kuwait for four or five months. We lived in a tent in, what was it? It was in a camp that was outside of the actual main camp of Erzan. It was like little, they made like little camps to fit and accommodate all the people there. It was a total of 15 females in one tent. Or was it all of us? 18 females. It was all 18 females in one tent. It was a large tent. We didn't have air conditioning. We didn't have doors. So we just took our flaps and opened them and kept all four flaps to keep it open to get air. We didn't get air conditioning until we moved up to Iraq. We went to Camp Cedar 2, Iraq, and we got air conditioning. It was a small tent, and it was seven females to a tent. So we had two female tents, and your living area wasn't very big. You learned to share your area so you could have a bigger area with your bunkmate, and you'll get to know that your bunkmate very well. I know I did. She was actually twice my age, so it was quite interesting. It was like, oh, I have my mom here. It was nice. With the food and everything, I'm not a picky eater, but I ate the MREs, and I got tired of them, and they made me sick. And I got tired of eating, grilled cheese and hot dogs and hamburgers because I didn't like anything else. And I ate a lot of salad, and then I finally started calling my mom or mailing my mom letters, and I'm like, please send me food because I'm not eating. I ate a lot of tuna towards the end. I mean, tuna and crackers. That was, thank God tuna was made because that's all I was eating after a while.
Living conditions for me were a lot like Specialist Stickas because we're in the same company. For me, living conditions were decent. You know, we didn't have air conditioning until we moved up to Iraq. But then when we did get the air conditioning units put in, they told us we had to pick, do we want air conditioning or do we want heat? Well, it was the beginning of winter, so we're like, we'll go with heat because, you know, we'll need it. So we chose heat, and they didn't get us the heat until the beginning of summer.
Oh, yeah, they did.
And we were like, well, take it back. We want air conditioning now. And they're like, well, you're stuck with it. So we got stuck with heat in the middle of the summer and no heat in the middle of the winter.
And she came into my tent.
So we would go into their tent all the time because their tent had both. So we would go in there to get warm or get cool. And as far as the food goes, it was okay once they got the chow hall going, but it did get very repetitive. We had what we called camel ribs. The camel ribs. The camel ribs were about that big, and one rib would take up your entire tray. So we called them camel ribs. They were probably beef, but...
No, they were camel.
They were camel?
No, they were camel.
Okay. But after that type of stuff, most of us decided not only to skip the line because in Cedar we were a rest stop for a lot of the civilians and other military units that would come through. So they would be in line, skip the line, skip the nasty food. We'd go to the PX.
the PX was always sold out of those little tuna on the go things. Always sold out of them because we'd buy them as soon as they came in because that was our breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I think after eating that, I dropped about 20 pounds. After eating all that food, 20 pounds.
What about your personal hygiene facilities? And also, you had some, I'm assuming, off-duty time. How did you spend off-duty time? Were there recreational facilities? Talk about this, please.
As far as personal hygiene, initially it was whatever we could do to stay clean. We washed our clothes in a bucket. We showered. And we didn't shower, actually. We just washed and bathed with washcloth. We constructed our own shower initially. It was kind of interesting. There was a snafu at some point because there were laundry and bath units that were in Kuwait that weren't being utilized, and there were troops out in the field and things that, you know, organizations out in the field that didn't have laundry and bath units. As far as off-duty time, what time you did get that was considered off-duty was spent either trying to exercise, read books, write letters home, those kind of things like that. We really didn't have television. Our unit did bring a TV with us and DVDs, and people had movies mailed to them and those kind of things. One other thing about the hygiene, once we got settled into Mosul, we actually went out on the economy and actually hired local Iraqis to come in and do our laundry for us and those kind of things. But initially it was, you know, however you could get it done. But
when we got there, we had what they called shower tents, which would be a tent entrance, and it was basically about a 30-long metal box with shower stalls in it with about 24-inch width between each shower stall. And that was, until we got into fixed buildings, that was the, you know, our shower facilities. We weren't living as Spartan as the folks up in Iraq. For recreation, they did open a recreation building after we'd been there about 2 months, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And they had televisions and PlayStations. You could rent games, rent movies from them. You know, just basically check out like a library. We set up our headquarters. We were able to get a part of a building. We had our orderly room set up, and we would have Pinochle Night. We had movie night where, you know, people were having the relatives send movies over. We had one soldier that brought his Xbox over, and we had packed a television set so we play DVDs on his Xbox. They would have video game night where they'd play with the Xbox, or some of our more adventurous people would have cigar night. Cigar and cribbage night, where they went outdoors because we're not allowed to smoke in the buildings, and smoke cigars and play cribbage under flashlights. So, and a lot of times it was reading and writing letters home.
When we were in Kuwait, I did a lot of reading when I had my free time. With the camp that we were at, we had little tent, like trailers, for showers. So we would go and just go in the showers, and they have ten stalls.
Five on each side.
And you take a shower. And we didn't have flushing toilets until, not right away, but we got them later on. So
when we moved to Iraq,
we got flushing toilets. And they had like trailers with toilets and showers in the same area, which was nice. And then with recreation, when we moved up to Iraq, we had, in my tent, we had a TV. Two of the girls decided to pitch in and bought this humongous TV. And they had movies, and we had movies in those days. I had my laptop. I brought my laptop and played computer games and watched movies. We also, at one point, had like four tents connected together, and we'd play Halo, and there'd be like 16 of us playing Halo. And you could hear each other yelling at each other, like, oh, no, got killed, and So we'd play that and go to the gym. We actually got a recreational facility built in Cedar 2, I don't know, 3 months after we moved in. And it actually gradually got bigger when we were, the more we were there. They built a huge gym. They had a TV area, cards, books, games, movies. They had a movie room. Then they had, like, a room that was just, like, news and sports. And then they had, they actually had an internet cafe. It's like a place where you can go and, like, use the internet. And actually when it first started off, there was 5 computers, and they were really slow, and there was, like, a 3-hour wait. And then towards the end of it, towards the end when we left, there was 10 phones, 20 computers, and you'd sign up for a slot. And they also had, like, an AT&T phone center that you'd, like, use your phone card or something and do that. And so there was, like, more opportunities for you to talk at home. Towards the end of it, that everything got better and there was more to do and stuff like that.
Geographically, now we're talking about your location in southern Iraq?
Yes, southern Iraq.
How far from Baghdad would you have been?
We were about 250 miles south of Baghdad.
Okay. This great big, humongous TV the ladies bought. Where did they buy this?
Oh, they bought it at the PX. You can buy stuff at the PX. You can buy anything at the PX. You can buy, at one point we could buy laptops, digital cameras, TVs, movies, CDs, CD players, MP3 players. Anything you really wanted, you probably could get it because a lot of people had money and they didn't know what to spend it on. So they would buy stuff.
Were you dealing in dollars or was it military script?
It was in dollars. You just pay, like I had my check card, so I would just use that. And I didn't really spend a lot of money. I saved it so I could pay for school.
What can those of us at home who may have friends or relatives or even somebody we don't know do to support our troops over there now? What kinds of things may they need, would they like to receive in the mail in addition to mail and emails?
The best thing out of the deployment and when I was gone at training, the best thing for any soldier to receive from home is always going to be letters. They want to know how everything's going at home. They want to know that you're okay. They want to know how, you know, other loved ones may be. Or just to hear, like, local events of what's going on. Like, my dad used to write me and talk about the Husker games, or he would write and talk about, he's a school teacher, he'd talk about what was going on at his school. Just to hear what's going on back home, because you feel so cut off from everybody when you're there, you know? It's like your parents' life goes on for them, or for those that were married, their husbands and wives, you know, life went on for those spouses, but for us it kind of just stopped. Like, everything back home just, you know, kind of just stopped. We expected everything to be like it was when we left. So just to keep us updated with just letters and emails, you know. And if you want to send anything to us, like, the biggest thing would be, like, more like not chocolate, because chocolate melted really fast. Like, the Tootsie Rolls, we would eat the Tootsie Rolls. We'd eat Girl Scout cookies, stuff like that. You know, just something to remind us of home.
I'd say packaged tuna, because, yeah, you're going to need it. Like, stuff that we can't, like, the little things that you don't think about are, like, huge things over there. Like, ramen noodles, packaged tuna, beef, cheese. Beef jerky. Huge in beef jerky, because that's a good thing to take with you when you're on, like, with me with convoys and stuff.
Does not melt.
Sunflower seeds are big. Any type of nuts. Like, we've had people with pistachios and regular nuts. I don't know.
Not hard candy.
No.
By the time we'd been overseas for about a month, we had stockpiles of butterscotch hard candies and Werther's and Starlight Mints.
And those fireballs.
And, oh, my goodness, fireballs. you couldn't even give that away to people when they were making truck runs up north. Actually, it was some of the things that really came in handy, and we were shipping this. We were getting a lot of this stuff in our extras. We were shipping up north. Believe it or not, baby wipes. when you don't have shower facilities or just to wipe the sand off the back of your neck. The little packages of the tuna fish and crackers, yeah, that was huge.
Oh, yeah.
They were like in the PX we had for a long time. People liked to buy soup. The only problem is they had chunky soup, but it was 500 cans of clam chowder. That's all they had. You couldn't get the other stuff, so that got old.
One thing I would say would be Gatorade, some kind of
Kool-Aid.
There's a lot of water. I mean, you have to understand in those types of extreme environments, you're consuming a lot of water, and it just makes the water taste a little bit better when you're drinking a gallon or two of water a day. It just makes it a little bit easier. And as far as for the people back home, the only thing I could say is just to not lose their support for the soldiers. You know, there are things that are being done in Iraq that are good. Regardless of what you see on television all the time, you see a lot of violence. You know, that's just not the everyday norm in most cases. And there's a lot of things that are being done that's good for the Iraqi people themselves and good people ultimately for the United States that's just not being talked about or reported. So,
because most of you were in the southern half of Iraq, I think that's correct.
I was in the northern.
Were you? Did you have any chance to interact with the Kurds at all?
Yes, we were in the northern portion, very close to the Kurdish, the Kurdish area. I believe they called it the blue line or the green line, and we were actually. It was very fortunate. The stark differences between the country itself. The United Nations was established there, had been established there for almost 10 years, and you could really tell the difference. The places where the UN had been. And the Iraqis were only there just to observe. They weren't really asserting or having any assertions or no authority over the people there because they were being watched by the UN at the same time. And you could really tell the difference between there and other areas like Baghdad and some of the villages and
stuff. There's a follow-up question on that. If you know, what religion are most of the Kurds?
The Kurdish people, the majority of them, are, again, like I said earlier, are Christian. The Arabs are Muslim, and the Kurdish people are Christian. I did actually meet some schoolgirls who took pride in calling themselves Assyrian. If you remember back from history, and the ancient civilization of Assyria and whatever else. So they really hold on to their lineage and their history.
We are getting close to the end of our hour. I want to ask this question, and whoever would like to respond, or if more than one would, that's fine. What did you see as being the greatest or most evident change from the time that you got to Iraq until the time you left? Change in attitude of people, change in your situation. Anybody want to address that question?
For me, it was talking to the children. You could see that they had different attitudes. At first, when we first met them, they were very shy, just kept to themselves. And then towards the end, they would start, they'd be playful, they would talk, and hearing that they would have more opportunities to learn a different history and, getting more opportunities to, go to school and for females to go to school longer in our part, and just seeing the different attitudes and how they were improving on how they lived and getting more. They have more running water, more electricity, more modernized, trying to get more modernized for them to live in a more suitable way for them to have more opportunities to live better.
Just a brief comment then, May, yes. If you will, please.
For me, it was the change within myself. I mean, when I went over there, I was 19. When I left, I was more mature than most 20-year-olds were. So, I mean, I felt about 10 years older, 10 years wiser, I guess.
So our sincere thanks to our Nebraska National Guard soldier specialists, May Sorensen, Amanda Sticka, Sergeant John Audismore, and Captain Martin Neal. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's topic was Back from Iraq and featured a panel of members of the Nebraska Army National Guard recently returned from service in Project Iraqi Freedom. The panel members were Captain Martin Neal, Sergeant First Class John Ausdemore, and Specialists May Sorensen and Amanda Sticka. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, March 24, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Dale Munson for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be Thursday, April 21st at 12 noon. At that time, we'll hear a debate between the two candidates for mayor of Omaha, incumbent Mike Fahey and challenger Dave Friend. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.